We come together today as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, having exercised our freedom by voting on the future direction of this nation. These are dark times, with the waging of two wars, job losses, stock market volatility, and international instability. But Tuesday night, watching the audience gathered at Grant Park in Chicago, I was moved by a glimmer of light shining through the abyss. I watched white and black, young and old, professionals and laborers, affluent and poor, side by side, hugging, rejoicing together, and reveling in their common dream. It's my hope that our American family has finally made room at the table for the disenfranchised. As Nelson Mandela proclaimed following his country's first democratic election, today we celebrate not the victory of a party, but a victory for all of the people. In this sacred space where we celebrate our common humanity, let us come and worship together.
This morning, during the time for all ages, I thought instead of having a conversation with the children and the youth, they might have a conversation with us. So I invited three people, Cordelia Wheatley, Kaylee Hazley, and Tracy Parsons, to share with us their thoughts and responses to this year's presidential election. Would you come forward? You too. Can you reach that? Okay.
This election has felt like my first election because I've never really understood politics. It seemed like it's all Obama versus McCain instead of being in an election. In my eyes, John McCain was going to be another President Bush, but Barack Obama seemed like he knew some things better than Bush. He says he will bring good change to our country. He says McCain will just bring more of the same old thing. The two candidates have really been drawing it out in our battleground states. Very harsh. But now the campaign is over. My first real election. A Democrat has made it to the White House. Barack Obama is our president-elect, and I am proud.
Thank you, Cordelia. Kaylee.
Okay. Every day and moment in between the time Barack was deemed the Democratic runner of the presidential election to the time he was named our next president, a sense of reason lined his every word. It was hard to envision. I was one of those people who didn't want to count my eggs before they had hatched. But when they announced him president just in time for the 11 o'clock news, it questioned my sense of hope, because if it was hard for me to envision a black president, how was I supposed to be what I wanted to be, and how was I supposed to get things done if I couldn't even imagine someone else doing it? So when I heard the quote, "Rosa sat so Martin could walk, so Barack could run," it made me realize that we all paved the way for each other and that his hope just paved a new way for me.
This was the first presidential election I was really interested and invested in, as I'll become an adult during the next term. The decisions made by Barack Obama will hopefully affect everything from college to my eventual Social Security. Right, yeah. The most important thing I learned during this election, unlike the past two, is that to vote based on fear is to lack faith in this country. And to vote based on hope for the future is to believe in America once again.
On election day, the leaders of our Unitarian Universalist Association sent bouquets of yellow roses to Marie Reeb Marr, widow of the Reverend James Reeb, the Unitarian Universalist minister who died following the attack on him, Orloff Miller, and Clark Olson in Selma in March 1968. Similar yellow rose bouquets were sent to each of Marie and Jim's children, as well as to the daughters of Viola Liuzzo, a Unitarian Universalist laywoman from Detroit who had journeyed to Alabama to help with the march to Montgomery and was killed by Klansmen while she was driving with a young black man along the Selma-Montgomery Highway. Clark Olson, who survived the assault that took the life of his friend and colleague, wrote this week to the ministers in our association to tell us about the gesture and the responses of the families with their permission. Ann Reeb, James Reeb's daughter, wrote to say that her whole family felt a sense of gratitude and peace to know that their father's sacrifice had helped usher in such profound change. Sally Liuzzo, one of Viola's daughters, had this to say. It has been a crazy, happy, wonderful 2 days. We have a policy at my job not to talk politics. All that was thrown out the window yesterday. My boss encouraged me to tell anyone that asked my mom's story when they questioned why I received yellow roses at work. My daughters, who are 19, identical twins, were able to vote for the very first time to help elect Barack Obama. Sarah, one of the twins, lives in Chicago and was not yet registered to vote there. She flew home to Detroit just to be able to vote for Barack. I cannot begin to explain the sense of pride I have right now for my mother and all the civil rights activists of that time. I feel like everything they fought for has now been realized. Black children will no longer feel that they are less than and will now know that they can be anything they set their minds out to be. Here I am crying again. Thank you from my sisters and me for never forgetting our mother. The three of us were totally overcome with emotion. I feel like Mom's sacrifice has now been worthwhile. Yes, she made a huge difference. I am so proud of America for getting past the limitations of race and for voting for what is best for our country. Liuzzo's thoughts and feelings have been echoed by people across the country and around the world. We have been moved this week by images of joy that have come to us from Grant Park in Chicago and from the streets in Nairobi, Kenya. We have been touched by the tears of the elders who never thought that they'd live to see this day. We have been uplifted by the significance of this success. Even people who do not share Obama's political views and did not vote for him have been inspired by the enormity of this moment. History says, "Don't hope on this side of the grave," writes the poet Seamus Heaney. But then, once in a lifetime, the tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. We are witness to just such a moment. A nation that was built on the backs of slaves from Africa has elected a descendant of that continent as its president. The descendants of families who attended lynchings of black men with picnics in tow raised money, knocked on doors, and made phone calls to help a black man become our president. It is right to celebrate and to savor this moment. And it is also important to remember that it came to be not just because Obama is an extraordinary man, although that he is. This moment came to be because millions before us organized and fought, worked and died for this day to be possible. White racism has been a dominant theme in our nation's history, but so too has white resistance to racism. The Unitarian minister Theodore Parker used his pulpit to preach against the sin of slavery. His Thanksgiving Day sermon, from which we heard a passage earlier in the service, was a powerful call to conscience, a challenge to make good on the promise of liberty and freedom. Parker used his pulpit and his pen to bend the moral arc of history toward justice. Parker was one of the preachers whom Abraham Lincoln admired. Lincoln read Parker's sermons, and from them he borrowed and adapted the language forever made famous in his Gettysburg Address, "Government of the people, for the people, by the people." Lincoln used his political power and oratory to bend the moral arc of history toward justice. We know that arc is long. In the generations that followed emancipation, overt racism and Jim Crow dominated the landscape. Mary White Ovington was a Unitarian Universalist laywoman whose religious sensibilities led her to respond with interest and openness to the events of her own time. After she heard a lecture from Booker T. Washington, Ovington was inspired to learn more about the conditions of black people in the United States, and she determined that she would work in settlement houses among black people in New York City where she lived. She landed a job in a settlement house, and from her role working within the black community, she saw the ways in which white racism was oppressing and limiting black people from achieving their full potential. As a woman from a wealthy and well-respected family in New York, Ovington had many contacts. She used her contacts to help found the NAACP in 1910 and served in a leadership role within that organization for 37 years until her failing health forced her to retire. Just 3 years later, after her retirement, the Topeka, Kansas chapter of the NAACP set out to organize a legal challenge against segregated schools. The end result of that chapter struggle was a landmark Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision, which in turn launched the modern civil rights movement. The moral arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. Barack Obama stands on the shoulders of so many people. His victory belongs to history. Indeed, the significance of Obama's election for our country has been compared to the historic election of Nelson Mandela in South Africa. There are, of course, many, many differences between our countries and our histories, but there are some similarities between the two. Both candidates prevailed despite the weight of history. Both elections garnered the attention and even the hope of the world. And like Nelson Mandela did years ago, Obama must now face the significant challenges of governing that lie ahead. The trouble with the economy is at the top of everyone's list, with the problems of ongoing wars that should never have been waged not far behind. Everyone is talking about unity now, but we know that major political differences will need to be negotiated in the process of governing. We need visionary leadership for our country. I hope that our elected officials will find a way to work together to help right some of the wrongs which beg for redress. We need inspired leadership for our country. I pray that our elected officials will remember that they are charged to work for all the people. Those we have chosen to lead will do what they can from within their spheres, and we must do what we can from within our own. I entitled this sermon, What Next? With one calculation, I can confidently answer, a whole new world. And yet, with another calculation, I have to conclude that much remains the same. I want to take a few moments to focus on three of the challenges exposed in this election cycle that I believe are uniquely our work, the work of the people, as we move forward, namely sexism, heterosexism, and racism. Though it's old news by now, I remain troubled by the blatant sexism targeted at Hillary Clinton throughout her campaign. The people who disliked her did not focus their critique entirely on her policies and politics when speaking out against her. All too often, they criticized instead her tone of voice, her hairstyle, her clothing choices, and her sexuality. Instead of calling her tough and aggressive, they called her names which are not suitable for a Sunday morning sermon. Sarah Palin got some of the same, but the sexism targeted against her was differently demeaning. Palin's hairstyle and clothing garnered much commentary, as did her parenting choices and the media's opinions thereof. But while Clinton was most often described as emasculating, Palin was instead described as something of a diva. Both are equally insulting and misogynist and reveal the work that we have yet to do before women will truly be regarded as equals among men. This is our work, the work of the people. It is intertwined with the battle against heterosexism and homophobia. Once again this year, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people suffered badly in the electoral process. I have to say that I wasn't really surprised to learn that Florida and Arizona passed anti-gay marriage measures this week, nor was I shocked that Arkansas voted to make it impossible for gays and lesbians to adopt or even foster parent children. To be honest, I think that I expected these outcomes, but I was heartbroken to learn that the people of California passed Proposition 8, the anti-gay marriage initiative, on their ballots. For those of us who believe in and have worked for the equality of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, this is a profound defeat. To many of us, it feels personal. We are disappointed today, but tomorrow we will carry on. Here's what I know. The moral arc of history is long, but it bends toward justice. People can vote against marriage, but they can't vote against love, and they can't vote against commitment. We will keep trying, and I'm hopeful that I will live to see the day when civil marriage is a civil right for all the people in our country. This is our work, the work of the people. And it cannot be separated from the work against racism, which remains to dismantle. Barack Obama's election will not make racism go away. It will inspire and strengthen, encourage and persuade. It has already done all of these things, and for that I am deeply grateful. I cannot say how much it means to me to know that my biracial nieces and nephews will grow up seeing a black man occupy the highest office, the presidency of this United States. This matters. This is significant. But no individual, president or not, can change the fact that almost all of the systems and institutions in this country were created by white people to serve white people. We have learned time and again that it is possible to diversify an office by hiring or appointing people of color to work in leadership and still not fundamentally change the founding norms or subtle racist practices that constitute business as usual. Barack Obama's election in and of itself will not change the fact that 55% of the federal prisoners in our country are black, though blacks make up only 13% of the population. It will not change the fact that less than 1% of Fortune 500 companies are led by blacks. Obama's election does not change the fact that for every dollar in assets possessed by the average white family in our country, the average family of color has less than a dime. And it will not change the fact that researchers are now clearly identifying over and over the many ways in which people of color suffer from worse health than white people, from infant mortality rates to death rates and every rate in between. Racism costs a tremendous amount. Almost every system and every institution in this country was built by white people to serve white people, and it will take a lot more than the election of a black man as our president to dismantle institutionalized racism. It will take us educating ourselves and organizing for change in our own spheres of influence. This is our work, the work of the people. We have challenges before us. Can we face them? Yes, we can. Ordinary people all around this country helped Obama get elected. If we decide to put our hearts and minds to the work before us, we have ample cause for hope. As Michael Eric Dyson wrote earlier this week in the Los Angeles Times, Obama's election does not herald a post-racial future, but it may help us usher in a post-racist future, if we are willing. History says, "Don't hope on this side of the grave," writes the poet. But then once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cures and healing wells. Call the miracle self-healing, the utter self-revealing double take of feeling. If there's fire on the mountain or lightning and storm and a God speaks from the sky, that means someone is hearing the outcry and the birth cry of new life at its term. What next? We have cast our votes for president. Now we must cast them for the world we dream. May it be so, and amen. I send you with these words of the poet of the Harlem Renaissance, Langston Hughes. America never was America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. Let us make it so. Amen.